Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Edwige Dantaka is one of the most acclaimed writers of her generation, having enriched and enlarged American literature with her novels and short stories about Haiti and the Haitian-American experience. Her latest, We're Alone, is an essay collection that explores a profound and enduring connection to Haiti, as well as a deep concern for her family, her beloved island, and the world. Dantaka's first book, Breath, Eyes, Memory, became an Oprah Book Club selection. Other bestsellers include Crick, Crack, The Farming of Bones, The Dewbreaker, and Claire of the Sea Light. The latest is We're Alone. It's published by Grey Wolf Press, and it is an absolute delight and pleasure to welcome Edwige Dantaka to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being here. What a delight to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It is just wonderful. I'm such a fan of your work, and it's wonderful to have you in the studio and to have you with us. What is it like to put a collection together of essays that take us through a very specific period of time and, quite frankly, a fairly tumultuous period of time?
Well, I'm always thinking through essays. Essays are really how I delve into some issues, how I pin down what I have to say, what I want to say. So over the years, I've written many essays, and after a while, I realized, oh, I might have a collection. And then I pick some, you know, I pick these essays because they're in some ways connect both. They cover both personal and political subjects and kind of bring me up to where I am today.
You write very early in the book that writing for me, particularly writing essays, is a quest for that kind of aloneness. You describe that kind of aloneness in the book. What is it about? And since the title of the book is We're Alone, give us a sense of that feeling that you're looking for.
Well, We're Alone, you know, the title comes from a poem that I had been carrying around for a while by a Haitian poet, Roland Chassagne, from the 30s. I'm considering, you know, the idea of being alone with a reader. So we're less alone when we read. And really, reading is an act in which a writer and a reader are very intimately together. Of course, we're alone in other ways. Some of the essays were written during the pandemic when we were sort of alone each in our own way. But mostly, I wanted to explore in this book this idea of being alone intimately with words, with reading, and this very deep relationship between a reader and a writer.
When you are alone with you and the words, is that a comforting place for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it feels like a kind of home because really writing is a solitary pursuit for any writer. And we often come out, you know, to speak about our work at the end, but mostly in the creation of the work, we're alone with the words, we're alone with our thoughts, and are really delving and digging for deeper layers to our everyday thinking. You know, what more do we have to say? And often that comes out through the process of writing, and that requires solitude. Solitude tends to be a very precious commodity for writers.
How does thinking work into the process in the sense of when you live through something, deciding, A, I'm going to write about it, and B, it's going to be in this way, and this is the way I want to tell this story, or how I want to integrate it into what I'm telling?
Thinking through is definitely part of the process of writing something, because the experiences that you're writing about in nonfiction certainly already exist. And a lot of the writing itself is figuring out a structure for that experience. So for a lot of these essays, often I would think, I want to write about this experience we've just been through in Haiti, whether it was our own personal trip there or the president's assassination. But we all have access to the same amount of facts. Some people are paying attention, others are not. but what else can I say there? What else can I pull into that experience? Sometimes it's historical, sometimes it's personal, sometimes it's reportage, you know, interviewing folks. So I'm always trying to find ways for myself, pushing the essay, pushing this form in a way that a lot of the essays in the book are what are called braided essays. So there are different threads that are coming together here.
Essays that have chapters within themselves.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, at the end of the final essay in the book, Writing the Self and Others, is and I recount an experience where my daughter in the summer of 2020 took this essay class with a writer named Erica N. Cardwell. And she, it was a class on the essay for teenagers, for potential college students. And she described the essay as, she asked us to consider the essay as a body of water, and the writer as someone standing on the shore and deciding whether to enter. I found that description of the essay very beautiful, and it's something that I started even integrating in my own thinking about the essay.
Edwige Dantecott is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new collection is We're Alone. I'm hoping you can read a bit from the beginning of the book, and you can set this up, but you have returned to the island of Haiti, and you're driving through, and you're looking after rain, you're driving through after rainstorms, and there is garbage throughout, and you sort of take this all in of what this means for this place, Haiti.
Yes, so this is 2018, and my family and I happened to be in Haiti that summer, as we were often many summers visiting family members. And then during that stay, the government raised petrol prices, and there were protests, and then we're leaving a night and it's raining, and we're in the road at that moment in time. And when it rains, sometimes a lot of debris comes through the streets. It feels theatrical to admit, but while the car was wading through that river of foam and plastic and God knows what else, with Solange and my husband and daughters watching, I felt like screaming, the land might never be pristine again. This land of mountains beyond mountains has already seen genocide after Christopher Columbus and the Spaniards arrived in 1492 and either killed outright or worked the Taino and Arawak to death for their gold. This land where enslaved Africans were then brought to be brutalized by the Spanish, British, and French until the enslaved people and some free men and women and some mutinous Polish soldiers whose descendants now live in Fond du Lac battled for independence and created the world's first black republic. This land was forced to spend the first century of its existence paying $150 million, now worth close to $30 billion, indemnity to France for this independence. Americans invaded, then occupied this land for 19 years at the beginning of the 20th century. This land endured the murderous 30-year dictatorial Duvalier dynasty until 1986. This land elected its first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in 1990, only to have him overthrown in a coup d'etat carried out by the Haitian military, some of whose members had been trained in the United States and were on the CIA's payroll, and deposed again in 2004 after his re-election. This land was devastated by a massive earthquake that killed over 200,000 people in 2010. This land was struck by several destructive hurricanes soon after. This land where United Nations peacekeepers introduced a cholera epidemic that has killed over 10,000 people and has affected close to 1 million, increasing the use of water bottles as carriers for quote-unquote safe or filtered water. This land where at the same time that we saw this river of scraps and discard, protesters were demanding the ouster of their president over fuel price hikes and corruption, most recently embezzled from funds from Petro Caribe, an oil alliance between Venezuela and some Caribbean states, including Haiti.
Edwige Dantica reading from We're Alone. Absolutely beautiful in the description and in just in writing that and in cataloging what this land has gone through. How do you even process that? Because it is so much. It is any one of those things is life-altering.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this even the idea of thinking of, like, this land and in Creole, yes, it would be Tessa. Like, it's just a really our history and a capsule.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted people to have at least this brief version of it. There's, of course, more. But often when people think about Haiti or when they talk about Haiti or then when they malign Haiti, so much is left out. And this historical context is left out in terms of, you know, talking about why certain things are happening in Haiti at this moment as we're sitting here speaking. And a lot of it has to do is with, as you say, any one of those things could have derailed a fledgling nation. But this compilation of this and more, including things that continue to happen in Haiti, making it very difficult to, you know, to have the nation that our ancestors, that our forefathers and foremothers dreamt for the country to have, for the country to be.
One of the things that you write about, of course, at the beginning is about all of the detritus, all of the scraps and plastic and so forth. The climate plays a large role in this book and obviously something that you're very concerned about and write about quite a bit. You look at this, of course, as a global problem and you look at it as a Haitian problem. But I'm curious as to how you go about kind of contextualizing it of how it fits in to our rash of worries in this world of ours.
Well, I think, you know, sometimes when the immediate needs are so great or there are these urgent political problems, we tend to overlook that aspect of it. But, you know, of course, the climate, if one lives on an island or, you know, is very present. And there are places that are much, you know, Haiti, like many places in the Caribbean, are much more vulnerable to it because, you know, in our case, there are mudslides. There's the vulnerability of being an island in hurricane season. And one of the hurricanes I think about a lot is the Dorian, right, which hit the Bahamas. But in also a lot of people of Haitian, there are a lot of people who came from Haiti to the Bahamas, a lot of Bahamians of Haitian descent who were in a certain part that was also very much affected. And more you see like this extreme weather. I think the interconnectedness of it we saw with Florence, which I talk about in the book, where people in North Carolina woke up and found they found containers that had come from Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and they were startled by it, but that had traveled. And then there was a whole saga of this trash barge that had been with medical waste that was traveling the world. That had started out in Philadelphia, that traveled the world, and ended up on being dumped on a beach in Haiti, causing God knows, you know, what kind of a medical damage to the population because it wasn't studied, but eventually with Greenpeace and other groups was collected. The Haitians were told that it was fertilizer, for example, when it was dumped on the beach. So there's this, you know, interconnectedness, I think, that the climate makes us aware of, like when we're all watching Katrina, for example, and watching people being treated there like we are often treated when we have our disasters. So it's one thing that I think few of us will be spared by is the climate situation.
I'm certainly capable of changing my thoughts on this upon cross-examination, but it seems while your work is often pointed, it never seems to contain great anger.
Mm. I mean, I process a lot of my anger through writing the through the writing, and that's something that came up a lot with Brother, I'm Dying, and people would ask me, like, would say, "Where's the anger?" and I think, and actually, one I remember one person who interviewed me was saying, "You could leave the reader to stew in anger." And I said, well, I make a case, I think, and especially in that book, I try to make a case and I try to present a situation and leave the reader to their own conclusion. But I mean, I think anger can be expressed in different ways. I process mine through the writing. I'm, in my approach, I don't like to be lectured as a reader. And so I don't want to lecture others. I want to present a situation as objectively and maybe as emotionally as I can manage, but I don't necessarily want to shout at people.
It's very straightforward. And yet the anger aspect, I guess, ultimately doesn't really do anybody any good, does it?
I mean, I think there's righteous anger. I believe in that. I think in activism.
Sure.
And certainly there are ways that anger can motivate us to, like, you know, to stand up for justice, to act. I think, I mean, for me, I think it's just not my particular approach on the page. I think it works for others, and it works definitely. There are moments in my own life I get angry.
Sure.
And that anger for, you know, especially, you know, about things in community, issues of justice, and that, you know, I participate communally. But I'm trying to think if there are exceptions. It's just I can come to the page in anger and something else emerges sometimes. Like, I remember for Claire of the Sea Light, that book, I watched a documentary about the situation in Haiti in which children are sometimes brought to orphanages by their parents. And then the parents visit them, and the orphanage knows that the child is not an orphan, and the child knows they're not an orphan, and but the parents can't take care of them, and this is an opportunity. And so I remember some of those children are adopted or allowed to be adopted by their parents, and I was watching something, and someone, you know, one of these people who facilitated adoption here in the U.S. said, oh, you know, they don't feel the same way about their children. And that made me very angry. And that night I, you know, I had this vision of a little girl, Claire of the Sea Light, who became a character in that novel. So that, you know, I think anger can flourish different ways on the page.
And when you say on the page, it sounds in your description that can either be an essay, that can be nonfiction, or that can be fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. It could be any of those things.
Do you do both simultaneously in the sense of, or do you work on an essay as you're writing a novel or vice versa?
I can't work on a short story while I'm writing a novel. I can't do fiction on short fiction, long fiction, because whatever the long fiction would just feed in, the short fiction would feed. But I can. Novels take so long that sometimes an essay or another type of, like, a shorter nonfiction piece is a relief, like a break. And there's a kind of urgency and immediacy to the essay that can pause things that. And I end up writing some essays that I don't often intend to, but something is happening that I stop and to write it. So I can do both at once, but often when the novel is on pause.
Edwige Dantica is our guest on this week's book show. The new essay collection is We're Alone, and it's published by Grey Wolf. You have a beautiful essay in the book called They Are Waiting in the Hills, traveling with Lorraine Hansberry, Audre Lorde, James Baldwin, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Paul Marshall, and Toni Morrison. This obviously is a very personal essay about these incredible people, some that you knew and some that you did not, but all who had an incredible impact on you.
Yes. Again, this book is also about being a reader, being a writer,
right,
reading. And these writers have been so impactful for me, especially, you know, collectively, Lorraine Hansberry, Toni Morrison, Paul Marshall, who I first read about in a collection of essays about Black women writers by Mary Evans. My high school history teacher, Mr. Casey, lent me this collection, and I started reading them in small snippets, and then started reading longer versions of their work. You know, and James Baldwin, of course, I first read Go Tell It on the Mountain, and then ended up writing the introduction to an edition of that, which felt like such a full circle moment. And I love that book so much because I also grew up in the church, and even though it sort of didn't step out like the character but had sort of these moments of being in the church and questioning the church. And so there was just, these books met me. I think these writers also met me in the moments that I needed them and really reaffirmed my wanting to be a writer. So I feel like I've been on such a long journey with these writers. And then Paul Marshall and Toni Morrison, I knew personally and had interactions with, and really brief encounters sometimes nurtured me and kind of helped me continue in my way of being a writer. So it was a way of paying tribute to these particular writers, including also Gabriel Garcia Marquez, paying tribute to them, but also paying tribute to the ways in which reading can change a person, especially a young person who wants to become a writer.
I'll admit it, you made me cry while I was reading this essay when you were talking about Toni Morrison. You spoke at her memorial service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't imagine what that must have been like.
It was extraordinary because we had had opportunities over the years to speak, and she had always been so very kind to me, including inviting me and with my family to this residence that she did for a month at the Louvre in Paris, and she invited different artists and writers, and I was just, starting out when she invited me. So I was very intimidated by that invitation to speak at her memorial. And I'm like, what am I going to say? They were going to, like, there's going to be everybody she knows and loves there. And then I read the eulogy she wrote for James Baldwin. And it's really a beautiful moment in which she addresses him directly. And so I tried to write something similarly where I addressed her directly at the memorial in the way that she had done for James Baldwin.
There's a moment where you're with her and she has invited you to come. And one of the things she's concerned about is that they took care of you and that you got what you deserved.
Yeah. Yeah. So my book Create Dangerously, which talks about the writers of my childhood, writers from Haiti and the risk they took to write, came out of a lecture series that when she was retiring from Princeton, they started a lecture series in her name, the Toni Morrison Lectures. And I was the second person to do one. Cornel West had done the first one. And so I, at the dinner for that, I sat next to her, and she said, she leaned over, she says, they're paying you well for this, right? and I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, yes, because I don't want them to be cheap in my name.
Which is just a lovely thing.
Yes.
Yeah. You write in the book towards the end, I'll ask this question because you talk about, as we've been discussing this, much of this book is personal and is about your family. You write, my mother never wanted me to write about her. It made her feel unshielded, exposed. I now understand that protective impulse, something akin to fearing the loss of your soul to the lens of a camera. The older I get and the fewer places there are to disappear in this all-seeing and all-knowing world, the more I want to hide. The Lord has warned that what is most important must be spoken, made verbal, and shared, even at the risk of having it bruised or misunderstood. At times, fiction remains my only veil. So you are concerned about giving too much.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's especially these days, my Create Dangerously, the book that was based on the Morrison lecture, was inspired by a lecture called Create Dangerously by Albert Camus. And in that lecture, he says that the artist is always in the amphitheater. And so the amphitheater is so much bigger. The amphitheater is global right now. And so I think there's still something about me that is a person that grew up doing a dictatorship, that is, you know, that was told, even growing up in New York, like, we have to watch what we say. So it still takes a, you know, sort of an act of, like, to feel like I'm pushing boundaries even by writing the things that I have. I have to get out of my comfort zone to not just share the personal things, but to even to give up my veil of fiction, which is where I am most comfortable. But I always feel grateful after I've gone through the process of sharing certain things, of doing this discovery. Because the essay, after all, you know, as in French, it comes from the French essayer. So it's a constant trying, right? It's an attempt at something and a grasping at something that you hope that you eventually are able to grasp and hold on to and share. But I'm always thinking of Audre Lorde, you know, and that idea of, like, it's worth sharing, even if it's, again, like, as she puts it, even if it's bruised and misunderstood.
Ultimately, you're the one who's controlling it. You're the one who's controlling what that narrative is.
Absolutely. And at times you have to write beyond what you share. There's a depth, I think, that comes from even, like, the trimming down from what you said. For having even written something down or having exposed something, and then you decide, like, whether you take it out or not. But the act of having written it adds another layer to the work. And that, I find that is true both in fiction and in nonfiction.
The name of the new collection is We're Alone Essays. It is published by Gray Wolf Press. Edwige Dantica, it's such a great honor and pleasure to have you here and to have you speak with us. I so appreciate your beautiful work and the time you spent with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.